Now, you may ask me to explain the origin of the foolish, and apparently chaotic, dreams that visit the sleeper nightly. These, if you have the key, are neither foolish nor chaotic. Very often there is a steady nerve irritation during the day, a firm suppression of emotions. This leads, on occasions, to the photographing of some of the causes of irritation, and these photos or pictures are bound to the neurons that have been active during the day. They, the pictures, were in a web of threads. There is no controlling entity, but the nerves can, and do, react upon them, making confused and foolish patterns. They are in every sense of the word nerve visions, and must not be regarded as reflections emanating from a higher source. I have defined attention as the direction of nervous energy into certain special cells of the brain. Now, if this flow has been violent and prolonged during waking hours, the vibration will continue. The echoes, as it were, of that concentration will still be resounding, but mingling with other echoes, other impressions, and these make a certain sequence that, at times, is added to by some very old associations. During the day, perhaps, you have seen a bonnet that reminded you of a dead grandmother. The actual reminder may be faint, but it will be sufficient to stir the thread that binds an old association to your brain cell. When control is relaxed, and sleep comes, the image of your grandmother figures in your dream. She has been drawn onto the canvas, through the visioning of a bonnet, some hours before. As the memory was of old times, it was far from the seat of operations, and the passage of time was necessary before it could arrive. I fear I am writing in a rather dull fashion, but what I want to indicate is that the memories, the images of them, and the nerves, play a game of hide and seek with each other within the brain during sleep. The spirit cannot send the controlling image, nor can that fluid shape, with its agglomeration of experiences, exert itself in the management of the vast population in the brain. I know also that, if the nerves be brittle or in a high state of tension, it is possible for them to be to a certain degree guided by a minor consciousness. But, though this entity gives the impulse of movement, it must obey the nerves which dominate, and owing to some harassing and latent memory compel the sleeper to arise and walk. This will account for sleepwalking usually. The nerves control the minor consciousness instead of the latter controlling them. But usually this psychic entity has just sufficient power to prevent the sleeper from falling into any great danger, or it can give the signal of alarm to the nerve soul, and cause it to hurry back to the body again and assume control. I have spoken of sleep in a rather crude manner, and I have endeavored to show you that it is owing to the need of nourishment that the nerve soul, or interpreter, has to withdraw and that this leads to an isolating process. The spirit can still animate the body, but only in very rare cases can it influence the directive centers in the brain, for its medium is absent. Undoubtedly during the hours of sleep a certain stratum of the subliminal self pervades the brain, or would seem to do so. What actually occurs is this. Certain old associations, old emotions, have been roused by events during the day. The nerve soul has not allowed them to enter the active consciousness, it was busy with other matters. They have remained there, like a stream that is dammed up. The dam is removed, through the absence of the nerve soul, and these memories, particularly if the nerves be in a state of tension, flood the field of the brain, and enter again the old frames, looking down once more on that interior where they had been, for a brief space, its decorations and the images of conscious thought. I will speak very briefly about hypnosis. The large majority of hypnotized subjects are not hypnotized at all. But, if I may take a case of genuine hypnotism, I will show you that in one essential, at least, it differs from ordinary sleep. The nerve soul of the subject is suspended, but it is not, save in a very extreme instance, absent from the body. It is not permitted to act. It forbids its own actions. That is an important point. The individual who hypnotizes cannot, unless there is some morbid condition of the nerves, compel the individual to give up his will, that is to say, suspend the nerve soul. Now the spirit, or subliminal self, is in a sense drawn nearer to the body through this suspension. Its creative flow no longer circulates, for it requires its medium and the latter is suspended. but another stratum of the subliminal self can be, and is often, summoned. I refer principally to that section connected with buried memories. Now the command of the hypnotist sets in motion some of the fluid shape, some of the essence directed by the nerve soul when it operates, it, too, being a part of that invisible fluid body. A portion of its essence is used, merely in order that certain sunken memories may be drawn to the surface. They could not come if the nerve soul were actively operating in conjunction with the image sent by the subliminal self. Actually, hypnotism opens up a more direct road to the subliminal mind, that is to say, that part of it which is loose and floating. The unifying principle, the center that sends the message when the ordinary consciousness is operating, is also out of touch when its medium is suspended. You will understand, therefore, that a part only of the subliminal self can be drawn on by the subject. Page 99 now. Chapter 20, Telepathy. May I give you my opinion as regards telepathy between the living? It is different in some respects from telepathy from the dead. There must be a far greater adjustment on our side than when the two subjects are alive. However, we are perfectly conscious of our inner mind, so, on the whole, it is simpler for us. If you are more fully aware of your deeper mind, it would become quite easy for you to act as a receiver or as a transmitter. But let me try and explain. I have already spoken of a fluid body which links up the subconscious mind with the physical body. Now, this fluid shape, as I shall call it, is constantly changing. It has an elasticity quite foreign to the physical body. It is decidedly impressionable, amazingly sensitive. The trouble is that it is not intimately connected with the brain, or, rather, the human being does not understand how to make that connection. He can do so partly by detaching his mind from certain matters so that the actual mechanism is not working at top speed. It can also be manipulated in another way. Now, there is memory in relation to the fluid. It can be tapped through the fluid. The fluid can also receive what you call the telepathic message. It does indeed receive many of them, but only in the case of certain rare human beings can the telepathic record be conveyed to the brain. I want to make clear that the fluid launches a message into space. It is not carried usually by any entity, but there are many floating filaments of mind which help to draw it into the fluid on which it makes the impression that may be conveyed from it to the brain. The scientist seems to believe that no physiological or physical means can explain telepathy between the living. I say that the physiology of the soul can explain it. That would at first sight seem a contradiction in terms, but actually it is not quite the case. There are infinitesimal particles not yet discovered by human beings. They are so minute that you would not recognize them as matter. But to the dead, who have far finer perceptions, these particles are suggestive of matter, though they cannot be said to resemble matter in most particulars. Anyway, these tiny atoms are influenced by emotion and will. These give a driving force to the atoms. The brain can give them the shape in which they are received. The nerve soul or the nerve memory is, naturally, very much influenced by the consciousness. I have already told you that it responds very rapidly to stimuli. Very well, the consciousness braces itself for an effort. It desires to catch the thought sent by the agent when you arrange a telepathic experiment. That mere desire has, with many people, the effect of stiffening the nerve soul into a kind of stillness. In that condition it is motionless. It cannot receive. The brain has sent an instinctive warning to it not to receive. In this case, instinct conquers the conscious desire. It is the instinct that protects the individual against the inroads of alien thought. In its essence, it is a right one. If you kept perpetually registering the thoughts of others, a very unwholesome condition of brain might develop. Nature, therefore, gives the human being this protection from the many arrows of thought that might pierce the armor of consciousness and injure the mechanism. If a human being has this instinct sufficiently controlled, he is likely to prove receptive. The nerve memory or nerve soul is, of course, very directly connected with the inner mind, which plays its part in the reception of a telepathic message. The term fluid must not be taken in its literal sense. I would not have used such a word in this connection when on Earth. But now, for the sake of simplicity, and because the nerve soul or shape is suggestive of something that flows, I employ this term which, at least, is suggestive and not in any respect technical. Neither must the words I have employed in connection with the planes be taken literally. They are symbolic of those particular states. Chapter 21. The interpenetration of thought between the two worlds. There is continual interpenetration of thought between the visible and invisible worlds, and that is what makes communication with you all the more difficult. If we could separate and classify the vast accumulation of floating thought from the living and the dead, it would be far more easy then, with the way clear, to send you one easy flow of thought from one individual discarnate mind. It is possible to get lost in the vast forest of men's fancies, more particularly when you go out as a discarnate explorer. You are pretty sure to pick up false trails and in the end to give up the soluble problem in disgust. I speak not alone of minds but of the continual currents of thought thrown out by such millions tossed through our mighty mother, the universe, whose illimitable womb harbors them all. I beg of you to remember that I am but a fallible shade. However, it is well in this difficult matter to lay down as our foundation certain premises. Firstly, let us take, for example, the average educated man. It is possible for him, while in the physical body, and while he is at the zenith of his mental power, to enter three states which differ very considerably from one another. First, the condition of deep sleep. Second, the subjective state. Third, the state of ordinary consciousness. You must allow much latitude for the subjective condition. It can vary to a wide degree. It may be induced by artificial means, through hypnotism. A subject well trained to respond to the hypnotist will, as you are aware, perform amazing feats, recall memories of early childhood, be insensible to pain, and, I believe, even obtain, at times, knowledge that appears to be of a wholly supernormal character. The Indian mystic can enter very easily into the subjective state and can, at times, learn of the doings of strangers who are many miles away from him. He can, in short, make mental journeys. Now, in our life, the life of the so-called dead, there are three states also, though it cannot be said that they closely resemble the three orders of consciousness that prevail for man. Even when asleep you are, in a sense, conscious, sometimes more so than when you are in this subjective state, for pain or noise may rouse you, whereas the deeply entranced man may not feel pain, may not be even roused by thunder. When we discarnate beings desire to communicate through some sensitive, we enter a dream or subjective state. There are two degrees of it that are important in relation to ourselves. If we are but slightly entranced, we are detached from the memory of concrete facts in our past life. Further, if we communicate directly through the medium, though we often retain our personality, our manner of speech, we are frequently unable to communicate through the medium's hand or voice many exact facts about our past career on Earth, sometimes not even our own names. We can enter into the deeper mind of the medium and read many of the memories belonging to him, which are outside the cells, or neurons, being joined to them by invisible threads. Now, you're aware of the strange association of ideas. You met a Mr. Tom Jones at a tea party 10 years ago. You had forgotten all about him, even his name, but someone mentions it to you. At the moment it means nothing, perhaps, but in a minute or two you remember the Mr. Tom Jones you met 10 years ago at a tea party. In the same manner, the discarnate being may find certain memories in the subconsciousness of the medium which will recall certain facts connected with his past earth life. Then the memory is rapidly communicated. I would now speak of the second degree of trance which may be penetrated by the discarnate being. It is a pleasant and, at times, very happy state. It is nearer to the condition of sleep and dreams than the one I have previously mentioned. When we are on this plane of consciousness, we can enter the subjective mind of man. But it is necessary that he should come to our aid in this respect. He must either be closely bound to us by ties of affection, or he must be what you call psychic. Very well, those dear friends or relatives, who through their affection or love, or intense interest in us, conjure us up in their subjective thought, open the door to us dreaming shades, and we enter again into the earth dream. We perceive pictures of actual earth happenings, imprinting themselves on the subconscious mind of the one who has cleared the way for us, bridge the chasm with their love or their intense interest. Often we perceive most trivial incidents mirrored on their subconsciousness. Sometimes, when we are really thoroughly submerged in this dream atmosphere, we can get into touch not alone with one subconscious mind but with the subconscious mind of many thousands. It is like a wide sea stretching out before us. Much of it is scarcely apprehended. We can only tap it here and there. But, with the assistance of the guide, we may draw out of this sea of mind the particular association of ideas that corresponds with a happening, a name, or a place in our earth life. We recognize it and use it as evidence of identity when we are communicating. Now, the third subjective state leads us to the great memory. But, alas, it is not the condition or state in which we approach our people on earth. We can gather up many of our memories when we thus reach out into the vast subconscious or rather superconscious mind of the race. So I will not dwell upon this aspect at any great length beyond remarking that those who have been among discarnate beings for many ages, those who are highly developed, the possessors of wisdom among us, can, on very rare occasions, while in the third state, communicate through a sensitive the actual history recorded in the great memory. But such beings are not suffered to communicate their own wisdom, for it cannot be expressed in terms of language, only an echo being sometimes caught which is rendered in the form of the inspired utterance of genius. Nevertheless, discarnate beings, who have only been a few years absent from the earth, in many cases cannot enter into this third subjective condition when they use the physical mechanism in order to give their thoughts to the world. It is true that we communicate by pictures or images, by signs which the deeper mind of the sensitive apprehends, and sometimes we may convey, by a sign or symbol, a name or word unknown to the medium. It would be well for you to note that what you call normal consciousness means the raising up of the barriers between your mind and another man's mind. But behind all that there is among human beings a deeper self, a subjective mentality that can trespass into the domain of other subliminal selves, that meets with few barriers. This matter, however, belongs to another story. I would ask you not to be troubled by my remark that when discarnate beings pursue an active, eager life here, the greater part of their concrete memories are temporarily in abeyance. Mark you, they are in a state of normal psychic consciousness under such circumstances. But a discarnate son and father, or any others who have dear remembrance of one another, may, if they so desire, recapture all their old memories of facts in their earth life if they choose to enter the third subjective state together. Then these two discarnate beings can reenact, if they will, the drama of their earth career page by page. They can recall all the infinitesimal knowledge they reaped with such care on earth. Homer, the Odyssey, all the painfully acquired Greek and Latin of schoolboy days, recollections of youthful games, of hoarded learning may be gathered anew in all clearness. The very conversations at tea tables or at dull dinner parties can be recalled and digested, perhaps with some boredom again. You can gather to you all the old rusty relics, all the little quarrels and worries, all your proudly gotten learning if that is your desire. But you must, of course, enter, with your friend or relative, into the third subjective state if you yearn to play again the old roles in the past, if you would wistfully finger once more the precious little details of circumstance and happenings in your earth life, if you would, indeed, be like some old man or woman who takes from their drawer ancient love letters, lockets of hair, and little miniatures framed in gold which recall dear departed days. But many of us are of an adventurous temperament. It amuses us, for a while, to dally with these pages in the book of life, and from them, when we meet our loved ones after death, we derive a certain wistful pleasure, or a quiet delight, without the pangs of the flesh attached to them. We tire, however, after a very brief while, of these heaped up remains of our past careers, all so carefully stored in the great granary. We would pass from out one fold of time into another, we would be bold and adventure into the imagination of God. So, while in this third subjective state, we turn again the pages of the book of life and read the future of our race. We gaze upon a drama that has not yet been enacted upon the earth, the vague echo of which is sometimes caught by prophets and soothsayers. We perceive the wanderings of those begotten by us, the fate of those who are of our blood, who bear upon their foreheads the seal of kinship with us. And, indeed, many of us sorrowfully close the book of life when we have thus gazed into a future that is not yet for men. Sprung out of the unknown, out of the boundless sea, which, I must again remind you, is the creation of the all-pervading imagination of God. Finally, the power to enter the third subjective state and thus to follow the future as well as the past, page by page, is bestowed only upon those souls whom human beings, to use a trite adjective, would call advanced or would hail as spiritually developed. Many millions of souls, who have passed through the gates of death, rest within the borders and limitations of their own psychic development. I use the word psychic here in the general sense, not in its relation to the study of survival after death. Such myriad souls follow a road and a destiny that does not, as a rule, lead them for a time, at least, to the great superconscious mind of the earth. These so-called dead remain in spheres and states of pleasant or sometimes disagreeable illusion. I cannot write concerning all the souls who pass to an invisible life from the arms of their foster mother earth. Chapter 22, Happiness for the Average Man and Woman. In discussing happiness, it is necessary to have a sense of proportion and to classify human beings. The life that brings true and permanent joy to one will bring only discontent and positive distress to another. Learned men have endeavored to declare hard and fast principles of happiness, and in so doing have worked on a false premise. Infinite is the variety of human nature. You cannot say to any class, nation, man or race, follow the principles I have imparted to you and you will discover happiness. The individual or nation in question may not be in a sufficiently developed state physically, mentally, and spiritually to be capable of applying such principles to their daily life, or, if they are capable, the principles may be so framed that the promised happiness resolves itself into boredom or acute disillusionment. For instance, the Christian and Buddhist ascetics and mystics are in accord as to the road to happiness. They will assure you that no true happiness can be derived from the use of the senses, neither can it be obtained by money or by power and authority over others. They recommend complete renunciation, scorn of wealth, power, beauty, in whatsoever way it expresses itself. They claim that true happiness can be found only in contemplation, in communion with God, in contempt of all those works of God which please the senses or satisfy natural desires. I am afraid their views are open to many and serious objections. For the mystic, perhaps, this inner life contain the only real happiness. But 90 men out of 100 are not mystics. They belong to a general pattern and are constitutionally incapable of putting such recommendations into practice, or, if they attempt to do so, they merely warp, limit, and embitter their natures. True happiness for the average man is to be found in such words as moderation, self-control, and freedom. He must first learn to control himself, and, that power once acquired, he must learn to control people and situations wisely. Thus he wins his freedom. Secondly, Tom Jones has to gain some knowledge of his own unimportance in the prevailing scheme of things. Thirdly, he should cultivate any special creative power he may possess. Now, his control of himself gives to him a certain serenity, so that daily worries and misfortunes fail to penetrate, fail to upset his calm. His power to control other people will save him from physical distress, from destitution, and will enable him to defeat any persons who may, in various emotional ways, endeavor to turn his life into a hell. His sense of his own unimportance will, in itself, bring happiness by leading him naturally to throw himself into other people's lives, so that self can be temporarily forgotten and a lively sympathy extended where it is genuinely needed. Now, the creative instinct is an essential part of a man's nature. Its wise expression should be one of his principal preoccupations. It springs, partly, from the sex urge, but often offers the greatest happiness in activities quite apart from sex. Whatever a man's sex life, he would be wise if he sought in some way or other for an outlet for the creative principle. If he has not a constructive mind or imagination, he can express it merely in the enjoyment of beauty in some form or other, in a wise but controlled indulgence of his senses. But happy is the man with self-control as well as real creative power, however humble may be the medium of its expression. Usually, the ascetic who recommends you to scorn money has no anxieties on that score. Either his friends or admirers supply him with all he needs, or he has an excellent income of his own. I therefore strongly advise the seeker of happiness to have a due appreciation of money. Without it, he must starve or experience such physical discomfort, such ill health, that he is unable to keep the light of his intelligence or soul bright within its temple. He is no longer free because, hourly, the clamorous needs of the body besiege him, and if he is employed for long hours at a small wage, he has no time or physical strength for the cultivation of his own nature or for the enjoyment he can give to others through its fruition. A desire for money in moderation is a virtue, for it happens to be a desire to become a complete man, and, through such completion and its resultant content, to benefit others. Happiness comes through effort, through a wise and controlled indulgence in the pleasures of the senses, through athletic activities for the perfecting of the body, through study for the development of the mind, and through toleration or a charitable outlook. The development of these leads to the cultivation of the spirit. True happiness will be found by the average man in the constant and wise use of all his talents, all his powers of body, senses, mind, and spiritual perception. Lastly, in wisdom will the modern human being find the secret of life and the secret of serenity. Faith, hope, and charity, all these virtues commended by Saint Paul, are contained within this lofty word, and all are made lovely by its radiance. For faith, hope, and charity without wisdom are without light, and things that are hidden in darkness may not attain to healthy growth. Chapter 23, God is greater than love. It is strange to me that God should be described as loving and good, or as jealous and vengeful. He is none of these. He is the inevitable, the omega of all life. But he is neither evil nor good, neither cruel nor kind. He is the purpose behind all purpose. He neither loves nor hates. There is no thought created that expresses him, for he would seem to me to be all creation and yet apart from it. He is the idea behind the myriad worlds, behind the unnumbered universes. When we speak of love and hate, we think in human terms. Perhaps we picture to ourselves the beautiful love of a mother for her son, we think of a man who loves his wife devotedly, we think of heroic deeds performed for the sake of love. Then we visualize hatred, our loathing of some individual who has tricked us, deceived us, or committed some rather evil crime. Now, neither human love nor human hate, even at their highest, can be regarded as qualities possessed by God. For in all love as we know it, there is some taint, some streak of desire. Therefore love is not of a purity which we can associate with God. And even the noblest hatred has in it some soil, so that we blaspheme if we couple it with the name of God. There is, in short, no phrase that we can apply to God in this connection. We might say, He is infinite compassion, infinite tenderness, but he is not the loving Father as described by the prayer book. He is something loftier and grander. A loving Father, in the sense the world uses the word, loves only his own. In a war, for instance, the English will claim God's love as their particular property. The Germans will claim it as theirs. Always man uses the term love when he wishes to imply that it is a devotion for certain selected persons or selected things. He may mechanically say that God loves everything he has created, but he is utterly unable to understand such a condition of mind, so this phrase is meaningless from his point of view. I would not cheapen the idea of the Creator by calling him a God of love. For, inevitably, I should be limiting our conception of God, I should reduce him to human terms, I would, in short, make a man of him. No, God does not love. For love is a human virtue that is like a flame, that leaps up and down, that at one moment in life may be a glory, but when there are many moments the glory cannot be maintained, and love becomes, even with the best of men and women, tainted by irritability, by some peevishness, or by some selfish melancholy. God does not change. His fatherhood and motherhood of the universe never falter, never fail. If he were love, then the marvelous creation of the life you know would never have continued so perfectly. It would have been subject to the changeable character of that thing you call love. At times there might have been cessation of growth, great harvests destroyed, vast tracts of country laid waste because the heavens did not continue to gather moisture.